Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 72, recorded the 26th of July, 2011.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello. Okay, before we get to anything else...
Yes?
We had a couple of people point out our technical snafu. It was Brian and Mike.
Yeah, they were the first people who brought that up.
Thank you for doing that. I guess when the power went out during episode 71, when we were recording that, then we went back to it, and some of the tracks had gotten messed up. So, no, we weren't really trying to talk over each other that much.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Yes.
And we believe we have fixed it now. The only thing is that the episode 71 now has no break, but that's fine. I'm sure you were all happy with that, or at least fine with it. The reason why...
So it's reposted.
Yeah, it's reposted in its correct form. So,
yes.
There you go.
So hopefully the power stays on this time and we don't have any more issues.
Right. So, yeah. If anything does come up, please feel free to contact us like you did. We appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Our first email today is from Andreka. And we've been talking about her test kits and... water and things. She says, you mentioned that my test kit could be old, which was a revelation. We had bought a $40 kit, which may have been on the shelves since who knows when. Every time we've had a positive reading at home, three different stores have said everything was fine. So I guess our test kit is a dud?
It could be. It's actually, Brian has some ideas about that, too, that I'd like to bring up a little later in the show. It could be that your test kit is bad. And here's another idea. Oh, another idea is forthcoming when we get there.
Okay. And then she says, I have yet to find out how many gallons our filter processes and what kind of biomedia. Our substrate in Cassius's tank, that's their beta, is about an inch and a half, a little more for the 29-gallon. Being there is so much, could that be a good thing, like having live rock?
Well, yes and no. It depends. But
I think... it's going to hold more gunk, isn't it?
It's going to hold more gunk, yes. And we talked about this in a recent podcast to some degree, that you can really go two directions with substrate. You can go substrate that is bioactive, that you really leave it alone mostly, and you let the plants take nutrients from it, right? And they're processing nutrients that way, and different types of bacteria grow down there when there's not as much oxygen because it's deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are a lot of good, healthy plants growing in that, that's usually a good thing. But if not, sometimes you can get pockets of hydrogen sulfide that are produced, and those are very dangerous for fish. So they bubble out, they can kill your fish. It's really toxic stuff. So, yes and no. If you're vacuuming it, you know, pretty heavily, and making sure there aren't any bad pockets, then you're probably okay. And if you've got a lot of plants in there, a lot of plants, like it's a heavily planted tank, you're probably okay. If neither one of those is true, it could be a problem. But it could be a good thing if it's got, you know, a lot of healthy bacteria going in there, the type that live in an anoxic or low oxygen environment, because they can help turn the nitrate that can build up in the water otherwise into nitrogen gas, which just outgasses and everybody's happy. So in some cases it is a good thing, but if you don't have a heavily planted tank, you might want to consider reducing the substrate somewhat so that it's easier to, you know, just maybe half an inch or so. So that it's, you don't get any anoxic pockets down there. And then it can be really good surface area for beneficial bacteria that take ammonia and turn it into nitrite, and then nitrate. Still, it won't be taking that nitrate and turning it into nitrogen gas necessarily if it's not as deep, but it will be a little safer in terms of hydrogen sulfide and so on. Okay.
Okay, very good. So she says, I have a list of everything from that podcast on my to-be-done list. So good luck, Andreka, and let us know how it goes.
Yeah, and thank you for letting us know that it's okay if we talk about stuff that we sell or magazines, articles we write, because I think that's cool that you said that. So thank you.
Okay, who's next? Adrian. Adrian from Canada with his big tank that we were talking about, various methods to change the water in.
Right, which he hasn't set up yet. He's just planning it, which is a great thing.
But he also pointed out problems with episode 71. So, you want to read this one?
Sure. Says, aging the water, one thing that I mentioned is if it works for him, he can put just put that pump into his big tank that, based on David's suggestion from last time, he can put that pump into his holding tank, whether it's a water trough or barrel, whatever it happens to be, and let that pump run for 24 hours. What I might do, possibly, is get a nice big heater and get that appropriate for the gallonage of the holding tank. And I'd put it in there and then use my hose from outside to fill it up
just
in the
house.
Hose? Carefully, with some assistance, yeah. Fill it up. Let the heater heat it up and let, you know, you have to be careful when you're putting the water in there. You don't want the heater to be on and get shocked. You know, things like that. So you don't turn the heater on until the water's
in there.
Yeah, and you'd want to let it go for 24 hours or so. And let the pump run in there, and that'll help the water outgas faster. And people do that. The only problem with the garden hose that way is that that's really cold water, so
you'd have to,
let it sit for before even turning the heater on. You let
it sit
for several hours.
If you turn the heater on when it's that cold, is that bad for the heater? Is it going to get burned out? Or?
Well, it can be a problem. You might want, it's better to use, you know, tap water if you can get it in there. But if you can't get tap water, that might be a possible option. But what I might do is let it run in there with the hose, let it sit for 24 hours, then turn the heater on, then run the pump. Well, no, you could run the pump the whole time. You didn't have to worry about running the pump. But anyway, it'd be a little bit tricky. But there's some other ideas, some other suggestions some people have too, so we'll come back to that too. And he says he's probably going to send us some pictures of it in early 2012 when he sets it up.
We'll look forward to those.
Yeah. And then, let's see. Now, Brian has some things to say which will relate to some things we've already said. So let's get into that.
Okay. So he's talking about pH.
Oh, yes. Now, one thing that I must have said something kind of dumb, you know, when we were talking about pH, because pH... now, I knew this, but I must have said something that was misleading, and I apologize for doing that, and thank you, Brian, for bringing that to our attention, because it is a logarithmic scale, which is like the Richter scale for earthquakes. So, you know, a 4.0 on an earthquake scale, on the Richter mm-hmm. scale, is a lot different from a 4.5. You know, mm-hmm. there's a big difference between that, or 6.8 and a 7.2, there's a big difference. Mm-hmm. You know, it's because... That's the way logarithmic scale works. So each time the increment goes up, so like what Brian says, the difference between the neutral pH of 7.2 and 8.2 is quite 7. drastic.
7.0 and 8.2.
7.0 and 8.2 is quite drastic. It isn't 1.2 times, it's 1,200 times. And that's important, and I don't think I mentioned that. I must not have mentioned that. And to just give you an idea of how that works with some fairly familiar items... Distilled water has a pH of 7.0. It's neutral. Okay?
Okay.
Hydrochloric acid, pure hydrochloric acid, has a pH of 0.1. The diluted hydrochloric acid in your stomach is somewhere between a pH of 1 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it varies, depending. Lemon juice is 2.3. Baking soda is about 8. Milk of magnesia is about 10.4. Ammonia water, like the stuff you might clean windows with, 11.6, and lye, 14.0.
Is that as high as the scale goes, 14? Or how does it go up?
I'm just curious. Typically from 0 to 14 is where it's mm-hmm. typically measured, so lye is extremely high. And chlorine bleach, household bleach, is somewhere between ammonia water and soda lye in its pH. So, yeah, these are vastly different things. There's a huge amount of difference between these things, right, that I was mentioning as I kind of went up the scale. So it is important to realize that. He gives an illustration of that, that when he had, years ago, he had a betta in a small tank, and he added a barnacle skeleton. You may have seen those. This one is about 3 inches by 3 inches by 2 inches high. You can buy them in aquarium shops and so on sometimes. And the pH rose to about 8 or 8.2, and the betta went blind from the pH burns. And this can happen.
What do bettas like to be at?
Bettas typically like somewhat acidic water, soft and acid water.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be that, though. One thing that's key here...
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Why did the barnacle skeleton change it so much?
Well, because barnacle skeletons are basically calcium carbonate.
And calcium makes it more basic?
Yes. Yes.
I'm not the chemistry person here.
So, part of the problem, there are several problems here, but one is quick change. In a small tank, if you have acidic water in a small tank, even if it's not all that acidic, and you add calcium carbonate, it's going to start dissolving that calcium carbonate pretty fast. And so it could lead to pH burn like this case. Another issue is that when pH goes up, the toxicity of ammonia goes up drastically.
So if it's more basic, the ammonia is more toxic?
Yes, because...
And why is that?
Well, it's because there are a couple of different forms of ammonia in acidic water. The ammonia is actually in a different form, ammonium, which just doesn't interfere with fish breathing or anything as much. It doesn't cause them as near as much stress. It's not as toxic. When the pH goes more basic, it becomes more and more toxic. So you can have a nice, slightly acid water, let's say like 6.9, right? And suddenly you do a water change and add water from the tap that comes out at 7.8. So it's a bit on the alkaline side. Mm-hmm. You add that, and then that buffers the water, and the pH goes up, and all the ammonia, if you had ammonium in the tank, then you have ammonia.
Actual ammonia.
So, yeah. It's
so if you're changing your water, and you know that your water is more basic than what's in your tank, your tap water is more basic, what can you do about that?
Well, there are a couple of different things you can do. One, regular water changes help. Because if you're constantly buffering the water, you know, this was a problem in old days when they thought about aged water was the secret way to keep fish alive, so you never changed your water. People used to think that a long time ago. Because when they would do that,
it was change such their a water, shock.
It was such a shock, and the fish were somewhat accustomed to whatever pH they were living in. It might have been acidic because of the biological processes going on in an aquarium tend to make the water a little bit more acidic. So if they didn't change water for, say, 2 months, and suddenly they do a quarter water change, boom, you know, the pH change goes through the roof. The pH changes, and so the ammonium becomes ammonia, as well as the pH burns that could result, you know, pH stress itself.
Wow.
So, yeah,
what
it's
are pH burns? Sorry, I'm learning a lot right now. I don't know all this stuff, so I'm going to interrupt you all the time and ask questions.
Well, basically, you've got a whole bunch of, you either have hydrogen or hydroxide ions in the water, I guess, and it's hydroxide when it's basic, and it's hydrogen when it's acidic, and if it's somewhere near the middle, you've got a balance of both. Basically, that chemistry in the water can affect the fish, and if the more their bodies can adapt to, you know, the levels they're at, and even their skin can adapt to the levels they're at, and their gills and everything.
Because it's gradual?
Because it's gradual, but if it's sudden, then they're going from, you know, it's like swimming in baking soda water to swimming in lemon juice kind of idea. You know, you make the change rapidly, and it could be very, very stressful. So,
okay, I have one more question really fast. In his email, he says pH or POH. What's POH?
Oh, POH. The P stands for powers, and the O stands for of in this case, and the H for hydrogen.
So it's powers just a different hydrogen. Abbreviation for the same thing.
Yeah, powers of hydrogen because of the hydrogen and hydroxide ions in the water. Or in whatever solution or fluid it's in. That's the idea. So thank you for bringing that up. I do apologize once again for not having either glossed over it or completely not mentioned this at all when we were talking about it, because it is possible that in Andreka's case this is an issue. And
so would her test kit test the pH?
Well, it depends on the test kit. Some test kits will test pH, and you have some that are sort of a global kit that have like the strips, but they're not always the most accurate when they'll measure pH and ammonia and so on.
And if her test kit's too old, it might not work anyways.
Right, and one great suggestion that Brian has is that if you take a fresh tap water sample just out of your tap to the fish store and say, please test this, you can find out
what you've been putting
pH is
out
of the tap. And that can also change out of the tap if you let it sit for a certain amount of time, because if there's carbon dioxide in
and
it which there often is under pressure, right, and it outgasses into the atmosphere, then you can get a different reading 24 hours or even a few hours after you take it out of the tap. Oh, break!
this isn't a commercial, because it's not trying to sell you anything. It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it? Okay, we're back.
Okay, and another suggestion that Brian had. To test the pH for the water, they may need to use a saltwater test kit if it's really high. If it's up in the liquid rock range,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, like if it's above 8 or so on, it doesn't always read in the mid-range test kits you'll get at the pet store for normal tanks, so you might need to use a saltwater one, or find a high-range pH kit, which you can do too. I've done that. Now, so hopefully that helps, Andreka, and thanks again, Brian, for mentioning that. Now, he had another idea.
About quarantine filters.
Yeah, I think it was Adrian who was mentioning that he didn't want to use the media necessarily from his quarantine. He didn't know if he should use the media from his quarantine tank, but how to keep the media ready to go for mm-hmm. next time. There's a couple of ways to do that, and Brian had a great idea. He said, for marine tanks, you often discard the filter media after it's been used in a quarantine tank, but then you get a new media, whatever it is, if it's a sponge or a cartridge or whatever, and you hide it in the display tank behind decor or in the sump.
So it absorbs some beneficial bacteria already?
Right, you get a colony of beneficial bacteria going on it, and then when you're ready to set up the quarantine tank again, you just pop it into the filter and you're good to go.
That's a good idea.
I love that idea. Thank you for bringing that up. Another way to do it is to put, some people do it by putting something like shrimp in their quarantine tank. But the problem with that is shrimp respond poorly to a lot of medications, specifically those with copper in them, but also others. So you'd have to take them out in between time, and even a little bit of copper medication can be enough to kill them, so you couldn't put them back in once you'd use copper. So I'd much prefer Brian's idea for doing that.
Okay, his next idea was about homemade cement rock work.
Yeah, he said he's made it, so this relates to David's idea about making this. And he said he's not sure about using it in a freshwater tank because a major component of cement is lime, and lime is a buffers for basic pH, so you can get it really high. That's true. And it needs to be fully cured in freshwater for at least a month before using the rock at all, even in saltwater.
So after you make it, you have to stick it just in freshwater and just let it sit there for a month?
Yeah, and probably change the water. I noticed change it several times in the meantime. I noticed mm-hmm. that online when people make the cement backgrounds mm-hmm. that they do water changes on it several times before they ever use it in a tank.
Sitting in the water do to it?
The buffers in the water go out into that water
mm-hmm.
and then you take out the buffers, and eventually
so it kind of
you get rid of the buffers.
Counteracts some of the lime.
Yes.
Basically.
Yes. It allows the lime to disperse into the water. You remove it with a water change. You put more water in. More lime leaches out in the water.
Okay.
You keep going.
Kind of like you do with driftwood sometimes.
Yeah, except it's the opposite issue with driftwood, that you have a...
It's too acidic.
It's tannic acid. So it's the opposite problem, but the same solution.
Okay.
Yes. And he had if the pH is above 9, I mean, that's really bad. You know, there's most organisms are not happy at 9. they die. So he said one great idea for that is a toilet tank. Not the toilet bowl, of course. The toilet tank.
That's where you let it sit?
If you have a small piece.
Oh, because then every time you flush it, the water gets changed.
The water gets changed. And you don't have to think about it at all. And it actually is more efficient.
Plus, it would be kind of drought efficient, too, like putting a brick in your toilet tank.
Right, which is a way to help conserve water. Mm-hmm. So that is fine.
That's a great idea.
And yeah, it's a great idea. I love that. And if they're too big for the back of the toilet tank, you just need to change the water daily in whatever they're in, mm-hmm. just like we've done with driftwood before and so on. So that's a good idea. And then you can test the pH of the water in the curing bucket before you start using it. You know, let it sit for a day in the water and then test the pH, see where it is. And if it's at a nice level, then you're fine and you can use it. And he has another idea.
Good ideas.
He's got a lot of good stuff today, as usual. It says, for storing and aging his water, he's got a bucket. It's a blue barrel that's about 12 or 15 gallons, and it's similar to the 50-gallon barrels that most of you are mm-hmm. probably familiar with, the
for
blue barrels.
For water storage.
Right. And he got it for free.
Free is good.
Yeah. It's a, from a home brew store.
Oh, wow.
And so he made a stand out of it from 2x4s and nylon webbing, so the barrel's on its side, and then he added a $4 spigot to it that he got from the same store.
Mm-hmm.
And he fills it directly from his reverse osmosis and deionization.
Oh, it's like aquarium filter. Water on tap.
Yeah. And so now he's got this really high-quality pure water.
Open a fish bar.
From there. Yeah. And he said they also sell other containers that you can use with convenient spigots. So that might be a good resource for aquarium things. We could put that
maybe send us some pictures.
Of his setup, that would be cool.
We could see how it works.
How
they want to try and put it together.
Yeah, something Adrian might be interested in using if he does that with a couple of mm-hmm. 50-gallon barrels, because his tank's going to be
wow.
so huge.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe just one would be enough. And then he finally has a link to the Aquatic Gardeners Association's aquascaping contest.
And thank you so much for sending us this picture, because I loved it.
Well,
it was so cute.
He didn't actually send that picture.
Oh, he didn't send the picture.
He sent the link.
Russ just showed me
the
picture.
And by visiting the link, I saw
okay.
the picture.
Well, then thank you for sending us the link so we could find the picture.
Yeah. The link here that he sent is to the 2011 contest, which hasn't occurred yet. But the neat thing is that the contest is free. There's no entrance fee. And submissions are by emailed photos, so that it's convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, technology is catching up and just making everything easier. And if you don't know what the aquascaping contest is for the AGA, check it out. The link is on the resources page, and it is really cool. I was browsing through 2010, because it's been a while since I've looked at it. I like to look at it from time to time, but I hadn't done 2010, so I took a look at that, and the picture that Kelly's talking about, you go ahead and tell them what it is.
It's Bag End. It's a hobbit hole, with the party tree out in front, and a little round door, and it's enchanting.
Yeah, and it's only done in 6 gallons, and it's amazing.
Which is really, really amazing.
And not all of them are thematic like that, but that was just a fun one. I like to
Did
start
it win
with
anything?
The, I don't remember, but it looks cool.
It wins the Kelly Approval Award.
I
How
think,
about that?
Yeah, yeah, it's a great tank, and there are lots of other cool
That's
ones.
It's a coveted
that,
award, you know.
Yeah, I know. They look great, so you need to check them out. I've only checked out some of them, but and maybe those of you who are into aquascaping, which I think is a wonderful thing, and I'd like to be better at it, you might consider entering, especially since it's free and you can just email them a photo. What have you got
don't
to lose?
Have anything to lose?
Nothing, and you can gain a lot even if you don't win. They always give you some feedback about how you could improve your aquascape. So there you go, and they've got some great aquascapers in charge of that. Karen Randall's often a judge. They've got several others who are great judges. So there you go. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about our trip yesterday, shall we?
Oh, yes. It was very fun. We took a trip out to the Great Salt Lake yesterday
yeah.
to collect brine shrimp.
We did indeed.
And we took all four of the kids with us, and I have to say it was gratifying to just watch them all out in the water up to their knees, having a grand time finding little critters in the water. That was a happy parent moment.
Yeah, and I'll tell you this was great too. Usually when we go in the past, everybody, you know, they have fun, it's interesting and so on. But I'm the one who catches the bulk of the shrimp, okay? This time, I caught a dozen or so and just let everybody sit back and catch them, and Kelly was catching them like crazy.
She
probably caught more than all the kids put together. I brought plenty of nets, but I brought 3 brine shrimp nets because I couldn't find my fourth one. I had left it somewhere.
It ran away.
But with 3 of them, everybody took turns, and some of the kids were just scooping them up in their hands.
Yep.
And then putting them in. And we brought a little collecting jar and put them in there, and then I transferred them with a funnel from the collecting jar to a gallon jug, because you're allowed to collect a gallon of them, is my understanding, without any license or anything. You just go and collect a gallon for your personal use if you're not a commercial outfit. So that's what we did. And tell them, do you have any other things to say about it?
Well, it was really interesting. I think we saw more color variation this time than we have in the past. Because usually there were white ones and there were red ones. And this time there's the red one, the white one. But then we saw orange ones and yellow ones and green ones. And were there a couple of blue ones?
There were. Sort of bluishy.
Bluish.
Tealy.
Yeah.
Color. Now, the interesting thing about that is that their diets and their the condition of oxygen and so on can influence that. So if they're eating a lot of algae and they're storing up carotenoids, that can make their color mm-hmm. be blue-green or orange or even red, depending on the concentration and the types of algae they're eating and so on. And then if they get really, really blood red, it's often because their hemoglobin is increased to compensate for lower levels of oxygen in the water. And it's beyond me why we were seeing some that were blood red and some that were orange and some that were white all swimming around in the same water right next to each mm-hmm. other. But there you go. They were. And since we brought brine shrimp nets and got them that way, we were just aiming for adults. But we got thousands and thousands and thousands of little nauplii that were in the water with them.
The water was just kind of a cloud.
A cloud of little ones. And so when we got them home and put them in a larger container, there were just these huge clouds, and I had to net them out just to make sure there was enough oxygen left in there. So we moved some around. We rinsed some off and fed them to the fish. I made a little video of the ones we caught so you can check them out.
Is it up on YouTube yet?
It isn't yet, but it will be by the time this is done. By the time this podcast is released. So check that out on the resources page too. It'll be on YouTube. You can see a video of that and of some of our rainbow fish eating some of them. One interesting thing about brine shrimp that people often say, they often say, newly hatched brine shrimp are full of nutrition. True. Then they say, after a number of hours, 24 hours after they're hatched, their nutritional value decreases markedly. Also true. And then another thing people say is, the adult brine shrimp have no nutrition in them at all.
Now, why would that even be?
It's not true, but it's true to a point in that if you have frozen brine shrimp that you have thawed and then refrozen, mm-hmm. that destroys a lot of nutrients.
Well, it does that for anything. People food, too.
Right. And another problem is people have spread that around on the internet, but if you look at some academic sources of the nutritional profile for adult brine shrimp, mm-hmm. they actually have a better, more balanced amino acid profile than newly hatched ones. Mm-hmm. But their protein has increased, their omega-3 fatty acid profile has decreased in proportion. So their nutritional profile changes, but it's not that
but
they don't have any nutrients.
They're
still good for the fish. And it's also true that gut-loaded shrimp have a much higher nutritional profile.
Now, what's the best thing to gut-load them with?
Well, there are lots of different things you can use. You can use commercial preparations like Selcon, Selco, things like that that are made for doing that. You can use spirulina algae, which is what I use, in suspension. They'll eat that. Things like that.
In suspension, so you mix it with some water and you put droplets into whatever container you have them in?
Right. And with the very young brine shrimp, if they haven't eaten anything, their nutritional value is pretty low. Once they've hatched and they've been around for a number of hours, they're burning off their yolk sacs. And if you don't give them any food, they're going to have very little to work with. And so
you can gut load the babies, too.
And then you can feed them, then their nutritional profile increases again, exactly. Okay. So, that's something important to bring up, that it's not that adult brine shrimp have no nutritional value, but you do have to be careful. And there are life stages, if they're not fed, when they really don't have very much left, and you need to feed them before they're useful.
You wouldn't want the fish to be eating empty carbohydrates.
Right. And now, one last thing that we want to finish with.
About the filters?
No.
Our light that we got.
Right.
Yes.
We got a Marineland Double Bright LED fixture that was rated for tanks 24 inches to 30 inches long. And we talked about this before, and we weren't sure we were going to get one. We were thinking they needed to fix it so that you don't have three settings, because I don't like the fact that it has three settings. One is off, one is blue lights only, and one is white plus blue lights. I don't like that because you can't just plug it into a timer and get the full benefit of all of those. Mm-hmm. Because there's only one outlet that you only one
off switch.
What is it called? That you stick into the wall.
The prong.
Yes.
Part?
Only one plug-in part. The prong part. Yeah. Only one. So you can't plug two. The night light into a timer and the daylight into a timer. But we decided to try it anyway. And, of course, there are great things about it. You never need to replace the bulbs. You might have it
because
for 20 years.
LED.
And the LED bulbs will still keep going, and they won't lose spectrum like a fluorescent bulb will over time. And it's double bright, so it can grow plants. And it makes glitter lines, which I like. Glitter lines are kind of the effect that you get from sunlight hitting moving water, and it does the same sort of thing when it hits the water. And they're useful in reef tanks with reef type lighting useful. They're supposed to be beneficial to corals. And in freshwater tanks, I'm not sure if they're beneficial to plants or whatever, but they look cool, in my opinion. And I think the light's crisp. I kind of like it. But Kelly has some things that she'd like to say about it.
Okay, well, I have to preface this. Usually I try to be pretty diplomatic when he asks me how the tank looks, because usually it looks fine, but if there's something that I don't like, I try to say it nicely. But he kind of surprised me with your question. I don't remember exactly how you asked it.
I thought I just said, what do you think?
I don't know if you even said anything, or if I just walked in and said, it looks like fluorescent lights that are having trouble turning on.
Because the glitter lines reminded her of a flickering bulb.
It was going too fast. I don't think natural sunlight goes that fast, and so it looked more... And since the blue was on all the time, too, it's a very blue, cold light, and I thought it... I think it looks more like strobe light in the tank.
So there you go. I think I like the effect, and Kelly doesn't like the effect. And so the jury's still out on the Marineland...
We still have the receipt.
LED.
We'll see if we take it back.
Yeah, I can always take it back for store credit, so we'll see. It's a good thing because it was $100.
Mm-hmm. No, you can keep it if you like it. It's okay.
No, so we'll have to decide. But anyway, that's our experience so far with it. And thank you to all of our contributors this week. Mm-hmm. Have a lovely fishy week. And maybe next week we'll tell you about what hatched this week.
Ooh, cliffhanger.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.